Airport Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons have business before the United States Airport Court of Criminal Appeals. Draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Lieutenant Colonel James Richards, ACM 38346. This court granted appellate defense counsel's request to hear oral argument on the following issue: whether appellant was denied his right under the Sixth Amendment to effective assistance of counsel when his attorney disclosed confidential information to the government that led directly to the discovery of evidence that was used against appellant at trial. Are both sides ready to present argument?
Appellant is ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then, appellant's counsel, I understand that you want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I was just about ready to repeat what you just said, but I wanted to introduce myself. As the court knows, I'm William Casera, along with Major Tom Smith. We represent the appellant, Lieutenant Colonel James Richards, in this case. And this is part two of the oral argument. I notice that there has been at least one new judge on the court, Judge Keller. It's a pleasure to meet you. And in summary, Your Honor, the appellant was denied the effective assistance of counsel when his attorney disclosed confidential information that led directly to the discovery of evidence that was used against appellant at trial. And as this court said, we are focusing on that one issue, although there may be some overlap with the issue that I argued here with what seems like a much longer time ago, but at least a few months ago. Your Honors, and I want to try and help focus the court and clarify that this is a Sixth Amendment issue. The appellant was denied his right to counsel, to the effective assistance of counsel, under the Sixth Amendment. And this right to counsel attached at several stages, but at the very latest stage, in the case most favorable to the government, this right to counsel attached at the pretrial confinement hearing. And I say that because there's going to be some discussion later on in my argument about when it may have attached earlier. And this is the Rothgary case that we supplementally cited, the 2008 Supreme Court case, which at least arguably overrules the Calf case of United States Harvey in as much as the date that the attorney-client relationship attaches. And if you think about it, it makes sense. What Rothgary says that relationship attaches upon the initial appearance before a judicial officer. And as we know, under the code and under the Calf case of U.S. v. Rexroad, a pretrial confinement officer is a judicial officer. And when the court thinks about it, this obviously makes sense. Because if one were to take the government's argument at its face, if an accused met with the attorney that is detailed to him for pretrial confinement purposes only and speaks to that attorney and says, here is what happened in this case, and here is why I do not believe I should be in pretrial confinement, if one were to take the government's argument on at its face value, that attorney could simply call the government and say, here's what he's saying, because I don't have an attorney-client relationship with this person at this point, so therefore I can tell the government anything that the accused told me. And what Rothgary
said. Sir, let me interrupt you.
Yes, sir.
You're indicating that attorney-client privilege only attaches at Sixth Amendment. Is that what you're saying?
No, no.
Is the government's position?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is I am analyzing this case from the Sixth Amendment perspective, and that the Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel attaches, in this case, at its very latest stage, at the pretrial confinement hearing.
Is that the full panoply of Sixth Amendment rights, or just with regard to effective assistance of counsel?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Judge, candidly.
Would all of the other protections under the Sixth Amendment, if we agreed with that position, would all of the other protections of the Sixth Amendment then start to kick in at the pretrial confinement hearing?
I haven't, candidly, Judge, I haven't really thought that through, but I think certainly as it relates to this particular case, the confidentiality and the right to the effective assistance of counsel attached at that point. I know that doesn't answer your question, Judge, but candidly, I haven't thought about it, so I can get back to the court during my rebuttal argument. But why it makes sense in this case is what Rothgary tells us is that this is the first time that the appellant or the accused is made aware and is informed of the charges against him. Now, the two cases, or two of the three cases that this court asked me to look at, Missouri v. Fry and Lafler v. Cooper strengthened this argument. This was clearly a critical stage of the proceeding as appellant was heading into confinement. And again, Your Honors, if you were, we have to look at it from both a common sense standpoint as well as the applicability of the law. From a common sense standpoint, it defies any logic at all to believe that the government is placing somebody in pretrial confinement, a lieutenant colonel in the JAG Corps, who they have reason to believe has had sexual contact with minors, but they're not going to prosecute him, or they may not prosecute him, so therefore there is no Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now, it's important that this court remember two things. One, that at this point, counsel is obligated to preserve confidentiality. And two, this is very different from the privilege issue raised in MRE 502. And the case that supports this, as cited in our brief, is United States versus Ankeny. That, and Ankeny states it as clearly as this court, you know, as clearly as can be stated for this court to consider. Evidence obtained as a result of a breach of the attorney-client relationship cannot be used against an accused. Now, the government tells you that Ankeny is no longer good law. That is, appellant simply disagrees. Ankeny is still good law, and in fact, if anything, Rothgary strengthens the holding and buttresses the holding in Ankeny.
Why is this information confidential when it was intended to be shared with at least one third party, if not two third parties, both Mr. Kennedy and the appellant's mother?
And that's the difference, Your Honor, between privilege under 502 and confidentiality under the Air Force Rules of Professional Conduct, which we cited in our brief.
So do you agree that it's not privilege?
It is not privilege.
Why is it still confidential, though, when you have people who are not, they're not agents of the appellant, they are friends and relatives of the appellant, and the purpose of this moving of the car and the dog is to have a third party involved.
Yes, and Your Honor, clearly, had the government known of, questioned Mom or Mr. Kennedy, they could not have asserted the privilege on the part of the appellant. We have no qualms with that. We don't disagree with that proposition. The difference here is that the information came from the attorney himself. As the Supreme Court stated, and I want to say that it's Rothgary, it may be one of the other cases, but people hire lawyers for a reason. And the reason why they hire lawyers is because they have the special knowledge and because they believe that they can entrust that information from the lawyer, that they provide to the lawyer. Because again, Your Honor, and you're to take the government's argument at its somewhat illogical absurdity, if there's a pretrial, if there's a third party in the room, and many of us who have done either defense work or legal assistance work have been involved in a situation where an accused brings their spouse into the room, and you can tell the client as many times as you want, this is not privileged information, and they say, that's okay, I've told my spouse everything, and invariably they haven't, but that's another story. And they disclose certain information. If somebody were to question that spouse, there is certainly an argument that that is not attorney-client privileged information. But that's very different from the attorney then calling the government and saying, well, there was a third party in the room, so I can tell you what happened and what my client told me. Clearly, that information is confidential, even if it is not privileged. And that is the distinction, Your Honor.
How is it related to his, as you pointed out, people hire attorneys for a reason. And in your supplemental sites, you cite attorneys' non-legal representations or non-legal duties. Why is the arrangement with a friend to pick up a dog and drive the dog in the car to another state, why is that related at all to his attorney duties? It seems like traditionally in the military that would be something that would be handled by a first sergeant. There seems to be some indication here that there was no first sergeant. Instead, there was a fellow co-worker who was appointed who said, essentially, I don't want to get involved with that, so this other arrangement was procured. Why is that related to his duties as an attorney?
Sure, Your Honor, perfect time, because that's the next place that I was going on my outline. And the government argues that Mr. Hawkins or Captain Hawkins' conduct was outside of the attorney-client relationship. The appellant disagrees. When dealing with the ethical guidelines and not the military rules of evidence, The ethical duty extends to all information acquired during the course of the representation. Let me give you the law, Your Honor, and then I'll give you the public policy argument that I think will answer the why. The law is Doe versus A Corporation, which we cited in our brief, NCPK versus Bergman, which said that there is no real distinction between legal and non-legal work, and again, the Air Force rules of professional conduct for lawyers, which clearly state that this information is confidential, even if in a, quote, non-legal environment. But the public policy, again, mandates such a finding. Your Honor, if you or I were sitting back and saying, what should have happened in this case? And what should have happened is Captain Hawkins should have said, this is first sergeant duties, or this is a company commander's duties. I'm not picking up your dog. Okay, but, you know, I think that's what all of us would say probably should have happened. Does that mean that there's anything wrong with the fact that he picked up his dog? No, and the debate hearing, the debate judge found that. But what should have happened is that. But once he undertakes that responsibility, and remember, Your Honor, Captain Hawkins, for whatever, I'm trying to say this in a nice way, but for whatever lack of candor the DuBay judge attributed to Captain Hawkins, he said at the very beginning he had a bad feeling about this, that he felt that he was doing something that was unseemly, for lack of a better term. So while these conversations, as it relates to the dog and as it relates to I forget what the other thing was that was, that he wanted taken care of out of the house. Once you have imposed that trust upon your counsel, it is incumbent upon the counsel to keep that information to themselves. So, again, if we look at what should have happened in the real, in the correct sense of the word, what should have happened is the counsel calls, the government counsel calls the defense counsel, and says, hey, we understand that some stuff's been moved. What do you know about it? The answer is, it's none of your business what I know about it. Thank you. Nice chatting with you. Because that's why people disclose information to their lawyers. And but again, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that have increased suspicion, though, and led the government to conduct further inquiry? I mean, it seems like if your answer is none of your business, I'm not going to tell you about this scene being altered, that would heighten suspicion, as opposed to Captain Hawkins' answer of, hey, it's no big deal. His friend came and picked up the dog and drove the car to his mom's house. It seems as if the second non sequitur, de minimis answer of, it's not a problem, here's what happened. Yes, he vacuumed the carpets and also ran the dishwasher so there weren't moldy dishes while my client's in confinement. Seems like that would allay suspicions as opposed to you're portraying this as a horrible breach of confidentiality.
I think there's two parts to the answer to that, Judge. Part one is, with all due candor to the court, that's irrelevant. You don't disclose or determine what you're going to disclose of confidential information based on whether it's going to help or hurt your client. The rules of professional conduct say you don't disclose confidential information.
Except as impliedly necessary to carry out the purposes of the representation, correct?
Which this was not.
But would it be a reasonable mistake for a fallible attorney to think I can prevent further searches of my client's property by offering this, what I believe to be an innocuous explanation for disturbing the scene?
But there's, one, Your Honor, I don't believe it would be, but two, that's not what happened in this case. Captain Hawkins specifically stated, I felt that this was something unseemly to do. So when he had that gut feeling, that certainly, at that point sends up all of the red flags to say, none of your business.
But he doesn't tell government counsel, it was no big deal, they moved the dog, they moved the car, but I thought it was a little unseemly. He just says, it's no big deal, he took the dog and moved the car.
But I think, Your Honor, I think the problem that addresses is, that's an results mandated answer. The problem in this case is not, and obviously the problem is the result, but when you analyze this issue, you have to analyze it from the attorney's responsibility. There is nothing within the rules that says you can disclose this information unless you have a bad feeling about it. You can disclose it, and you're right, what it says is unless it furthers your client's cause, this doesn't further the client's cause.
Well, we know in retrospect it didn't. I guess what I'm asking is in the context of an IAC claim, when you're dealing with fallible lawyers, Is it a reasonable mistake to think this furthers my client's cause to offer this innocuous explanation?
I don't think it is, and there's no evidence that that's what Captain Hawkins was thinking. I mean, he had the chance at the debate hearing to say that, and he certainly didn't. So there's no evidence of that. Your Honor, does that answer your question?
It does, but I have a follow-up question,
please.
And that is Rule 3.4, Fairness to Opposing Party and Counsel, and it talks about a lawyer shall not unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully alter, destroy, or conceal a document or other material having potential evidentiary value. And it seems as if that's what you're indicating, though, is that Captain Hawkins at this point has a suspicion, once he's confronted by the trial counsel, that evidence has been altered or now concealed or moved out of the scene. So doesn't he, and you said he doesn't have any duty to disclose this information, but doesn't Rule 3.4 actually impose a duty to disclose that information at this point?
I don't believe it does, Judge, because one, he had no real knowledge, I mean, no concrete knowledge that a crime had occurred. Okay. And I think what that rule is geared towards is...
Well, the rule doesn't require crime. It requires the altering or moving of information of potential evidentiary value. I mean, it seems as if you're saying it's not the innocuous situation or the innocent situation, let me say, of it's just the dog in the car. It's now that he has some suspicions. But if he has some suspicions, then doesn't Rule 3.4 require him to say... Evidence may have been removed from this scene. Here's who was in the house and may have removed that evidence.
Well, Your Honor, first off, I think that the rule, by its very nature, has to be limited by a breach of the attorney-client privilege. Because otherwise, respectfully, as defense counsel, our clients sometimes have committed crimes. I know that that may shock many people, but sometimes people I've represented have committed crimes. I have knowledge about those crimes. Obviously, that rule has to be limited by my inability to breach the attorney-client privilege, or it may require me during every case to say, if you want to know where the body is located, here's where the body is located. It has to be limited by privilege or by confidential information, by its very nature.
But isn't it also limited by the attorney's involvement? It's different where your client has said, here's where the body is, it's in the tool shed. The tool shed also contains the smoking gun and my videotaped confession. Clearly, I think both sides would agree the attorney cannot reveal that information. It's different, though, isn't it, when the attorney's involved with the third party to alter, to move, to conceal that information, whether the attorney knew that at the time or doesn't find out till afterwards, oh, when we hid that shovel or moved it to another location, I now understand that was the shovel used to bludgeon the victim. Clearly, that's not the case we're talking about here, but using that hypothetical, isn't that what it's limited by, is the attorney's involvement in the concealment or alteration?
And I would argue in that case, Your Honor, the attorney cannot call the government, and certainly as happened in this case, the government cannot call the defense counsel and say, where's the shovel? And the attorney cannot say, here's where the shovel is. Because
so by you're saying that the attorney could move the shovel and then has no obligation to tell anybody where the shovel is.
Assuming the attorney did not know, I mean, he's not picking up a shovel drenched in blood, obviously, because no attorney is going to do that. Assuming the attorney does not know that that's where what the shovel was used for, I would certainly argue that the attorney cannot call the government and the government cannot compel from the attorney, where's the shovel?
Let me ask you, too, have you distinguished the case of Fisher versus United States, 425 U.S. 391, when it talks about delivery of items must have been for the purpose of attaining legal advice, and attorney-client privilege protects only those disclosures which are necessary to obtain informed legal advice which might not have been made absent the privilege? The issue here with the moving of the dog in the car doesn't seem like the involvement of the attorney for this portion was for the purpose of obtaining legal advice. It is, as we're sort of generally referring to it, as first sergeant duties.
So how do you distinguish the Fisher case?
Sure. And it's interesting, Judge, because we were just having this discussion. When the court first gave me the Fisher case, I kept reading it and going, okay, not really sure why you did. But now I know. And and I think that you have to look at a couple of different things, Your Honor. This deals with the prejudice prong. First off, in this case, there is absolutely no evidence that the government knew of the existence of that piece of paper. So we don't even have to get to Fisher because we have no evidence in the record that the government knew of the piece of paper. I'm assuming that's what the court is asking about, is the piece of paper with the passwords on it, Judge? I don't want to answer a question you're not asking.
Well, the piece of paper with the passwords is what ultimately is discovered with evidentiary
right.
value. I think both sides would agree the dog in the car had no evidentiary value. But that's the initial revelation, is a friend went into the house to get the dog in the car, may have taken some other stuff. Here's the friend's name.
Right.
So why is that information about the dog in the car and who moved it and who had access to the house, why is that not under the Fisher case in terms of that's not related to attorney duties, that's not related to attorney obligations, and therefore under the Fisher logic, the information about the dog in the car, although it may lead to other information that has evidentiary value, the information about the dog in the car, not privileged, not confidential.
And again, Your Honor, I don't think we ever get to Fisher in this case. And we don't get to Fisher for two reasons. One, this is not a judicial subpoena. The government doesn't come at this case with clean hands. While we have correctly laid much of the blame in this case at the feet of Captain Hawkins, the government does not come at this case with clean hands. The government is the one who questioned Captain Hawkins, knowing that, or at least suspecting that, he may disclose privileged information. So we don't get to Fisher because we do not have a judicial subpoena. The second reason why we do not have a judicial subpoena is the government had no probable cause to search Mom's house. In fact, they had not searched Mom's house in all of the time leading up to this, what happened with regards to Captain Hawkins. Thirdly, the government not only had not searched Mom's house, they had no probable cause to search Mom's house. So we don't even get to the Fisher issue in this case, Judge, because we're not dealing with a judicially mandated subpoena, and the government had no probable cause to seek a subpoena, and in fact had not done so.
You mentioned prejudice. Let me ask you real quick.
Yes, sir.
Page 27 of your supplemental brief,
oh boy,
you talk about inevitable discovery.
Yes, sir.
And the government's obligation to show reasonable probability the evidence would have been discovered.
Yes, sir.
In the Fourth Amendment context, the government has the burden of production and persuasion.
Yes.
I think we agree in this context the appellant has the burden of production and persuasion with regard to the IAC claim.
We have the burden with regard to the IAC claim. I do not believe we have the burden as it relates to inevitable discovery.
Why is that?
Because the only close analogy is the Fourth Amendment arena, in which case the burden falls on the appellant or on the government. We could not, obviously, say the government could not have done something. It is up to the government and incumbent upon the government to say, but for these actions, we would have inevitably discovered it. And there's really, I'm sorry, Judge.
If the appellant has the burden of showing prejudice, then doesn't that put him on the same footing as the government in the Fourth Amendment context?
I don't believe it does, because the prejudice is the fact that the government obtained this evidence. Then that shifts the burden, I would argue, to the government to say, well, they would have discovered this evidence anyway. And
I guess my question is, if the appellant's burden is to show prejudice and there's no evidence, I mean, that's kind of what you argue on page 27 at least, is the government didn't produce evidence. But in order to show prejudice, wouldn't the appellant have to show it was disclosed and it would not have been discovered without that disclosure?
No, Your Honor. I think the prejudice is the fact that it was disclosed. I think our argument ends there. However, go ahead, Judge. I'm sorry. I don't want to.
Well, I'm trying to articulate or trying to think through in my own mind how that would show up in the opinion as prejudicial to a fundamental right. You're saying that the mere fact that it was disclosed and it was a violation of his ethical duty, that is prejudicial in the fair trial context?
That is what Ann Kenney tells us. Yes, sir. I mean, I think Ankeny makes that very clear when it says that this evidence cannot be used. And Ankeny never gets to, and in fact, Ankeny is a great case in terms of that analogy, Judge, or that question, because in that case, arguably, I mean, what the SJA learned was that the appellant had attempted to bribe the urinalysis observer. Well, I think it's clear that during the course of any drug prosecution, one of the people the government's going to interview is the person who took the urinalysis. But notice that neither the Navy Court nor CAF ever reached that issue, because CAF simply used the language that if it's obtained in violation of the confidentiality requirement, then it may not be used against the appellant. But Your Honors, I believe my time is up. I'm confused as to, and it's my bad. I've got 5 minutes to go. Look at that. Okay.
Well, you have 5 minutes to go.
But that's my rebuttal.
That's your rebuttal.
Then I am correct that my time is up. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, this concludes my presentation until rebuttal. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am Major Thomas Alford, along with Mr. Roger Bruce. We represent the United States in this case. The information disclosed on 18 May 2012 to trial counsel by Mr. Hawkins was not confidential because at no time was the information intended to be confidential, nor did the information at all relate to the representation of appellant. Based on these factual realities, specifically emphasized by the Dubé military judge's amply supported findings of fact, this court can easily resolve the issue presented. Moreover, appellant suffered no prejudice to any constitutional right because after listening to a confinement phone call appellant made to his mother on 6 May of 2012, trial counsel discovered that some of appellant's personal items were located at his mother's house in New Jersey. Based on these confinement phone calls, trial counsel was also independently on his way to discovering Mr. Paul Kennedy, who, when contacted by trial counsel, readily provided trial counsel with the details and a list that trial counsel was not aware of, and the details regarding appellant's plan to move the items from his home. Furthermore, the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of effective assistance of counsel had not yet attached at the time of the disclosure by Mr. Hawkins on 18 May of 2012, over a month before the charges were preferred in this case. Therefore, appellant is devoid of a Sixth Amendment remedy. So to start out, Your Honors, I'd like to just start out with the ineffective assistance of counsel framework that you typically deal with. And I know that we have an issue dealing with whether that even attaches, which I'll address later on in the argument. But assuming for the sake of argument that you will apply some kind of IAC framework, typically that framework that is used, as this Court knows, is the Strickland framework or the Polk framework. It's either a two-prong or a three-prong test. Now, looking at the Polk standard, the first question is, are the appellant's allegations true? And I think the Dubé judge and the affidavits provided show that the allegation, at least that this conversation happened, was indeed true. But then the follow-up question is there a reasonable explanation for counsel's action in this case? And the second prong of Polk is, if the allegations are true, did the level of advocacy fall measurably below the standard ordinarily expected of fallible lawyers? So when viewing those two prongs together, essentially an elaboration of the first prong of Strickland, you're looking at, is the conduct on behalf of the defense counsel, is it reasonable? You're not looking at whether it was the best choice. You're not looking at whether it was the perfect choice. You're looking at whether it was reasonable under the circumstances.
Is that objective or subjective? Do we take into account what Captain Hawkins may have suspected at the time? Or do we just look at it objectively and say, could a lawyer have disclosed this for a reasonable purpose?
As far as the Supreme Court has indicated, it appears to be an objective test. If you look at the Padilla case, if you look at Nix v. Whiteside, which I provided the court in a supplemental cite, they kind of talk about that objective test in the sense that we use the model rules not as a hard and fast rule. In Nix v. Whiteside, they specifically said your objective in a Sixth Amendment analysis is not to constitutionalize the model rules, but they serve as a guide for courts to determine where is reasonableness in kind of the general area that we're dealing with. So here we're dealing with two things. Number one, was there a privilege under the military rules of evidence? And number two, as appellant hangs his entire argument on, is this model rule in determining whether or not that conduct fell measurably below the standard ordinarily expected of fallible lawyers. Now, looking at privilege, appellant has just conceded, and he concedes in his reply brief, as we pointed out on page 19, that the privilege does not apply here. And in particular, I just want to point out another case he hangs his hat on, Ann Kenny, was a privilege case. And most of the cases that you see dealing with these types of issues are privilege cases. And he acknowledges that the privilege was destroyed. There was no privilege. If you read Military Rule of Evidence 502, it says a communication is confidential, quote, if not intended to be disclosed to third persons other than those to whom disclosure is in furtherance of the rendition of professional legal services to the client or those reasonably necessary for the transmission of the communication, unquote. And also, Military Rule of Evidence 510 also indicates that the privilege was destroyed by the presence of the third party. So the next step of the analysis in determining whether this was reasonable conduct, assuming we're using that framework, is you move on to the model rules 1.6 and 1.8. In looking at the model rules, appellant's argument essentially is that we need to get rid of the entire portion in 1.6 that talks about related to the representation. He's saying that's not a factor. In the Second Circuit case he cites, essentially he's trying to show that personal errands don't matter, that everything is related to the representation. But the key here for this court to acknowledge is that appellant himself is a lieutenant colonel in the JAG Corps. He is an experienced lawyer. He told his captain defense counsel, when the captain defense counsel had a little bit of a reservation about what was going on, he told his defense counsel, this is a personal errand. This isn't a case where the lawyer is after the fact saying, oh, I thought this was just a personal errand. The military judge found in the Dubay factual findings, which is, again, amply supported by the record, that appellant directed him to engage in a personal errand. And so that immediately kills any confidentiality as well, because if this was a non-legal request, and remember, Hawkins only thought that a shot records folder for the dog and the car were being moved. He didn't know anything about the list. That was something Paul Kennedy provided after the fact. So he had no idea that there was anything else being moved out of the home. Now, I know there was some discussion about him directing the paralegal to move a laptop bag out of the home, and that may or may not have happened. But that still doesn't go to moving any kind of items that Hawkins reasonably would have thought were anything of evidentiary value. Also, I want to point out the El Paso case. It's a Fifth Circuit case, and it's cited all throughout the federal circuits when you look at what destroys confidentiality. And if you look at that El Paso case, it says a client's disclosure of confidential documents direct to a third party destroys confidentiality and attorney-client privilege protection for those documents. And I apologize, I can't help but research up until the last minute. I also found, and I'll provide a supplementary site, a Army Court of Military Review case. I know not particularly persuasive, but from 1993, that's U.S. v. Nelson, 38 NJ 710. That also talks about that third parties destroy not just privilege, but also confidentiality. Another important point, if I could point this court to the record in the Dubay proceeding at pages 33 and 36, appellant never told anybody to keep this a secret. He didn't tell Kennedy to keep it a secret. He didn't tell Hawkins when Hawkins was directed by appellant to contact, actually, there's not just two people involved in this. There's Kennedy, there's the mother, and then there's Captain Sam Miller, He had nothing to do with appellant. He wasn't a close friend of appellant or anything. And appellant directed Hawkins to contact Captain Sam Miller. And nowhere in that discussion was there any kind of indication that it should be kept secret to Captain Miller as well. And I want to point out, too.
A requirement for attorney-client privilege or for confidentiality that the client has to tell the attorney, hey, I need you to keep this secret? And shouldn't the attorney's duties for attorney-client privilege and the duty of confidentiality, aren't they self-imposed?
They are, Your Honor, but when you're looking at then was it intended to be confidential? Well, I think privilege, it would be killed by the existence of a third party, so we'll put that aside. But confidentiality, I think you need to determine whether it's intended to be confidential. If your client is telling you, hey, listen, I want you to contact these three people and to have you do a personal errand, that in Hawkins' shoes, if we could step in Hawkins' shoes for a moment, reasonably he has no indication that this is something he needs to keep secret because he's being reassured by his client. Mr. Kennedy looks like he's just kind of an innocent party. He doesn't look like he's up to anything nefarious or anything like that. So I think it's a factor that you have to consider. But, no, the client doesn't have to tell you specifically that it has to be confidential. But, essentially, to flip that around, appellant's argument is that, essentially, that the client has to pre-approve anything you talk about related to the representation or not related to the representation before you disclose it to trial counsel. So that would essentially cripple any kind of plea negotiations, any kind of other rapport building with the prosecutor, anything like that. And I also want to point out to this court, and this is, I can't stress this enough, in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, it is the appellant's burden to prove these prongs. Appellant didn't testify at the Dubé hearing. The only witness that they called was Sergeant Bambarger. He had his opportunity to challenge prejudice and to challenge any other factual notions, and he did not. So that is an important factor for this court to consider as well. And also in the Dubé record at page 40, this isn't just Captain Hawkins we're talking about. Captain Goins, who is the next ADC, was contacted by Paul Kennedy. And Paul Kennedy said, is it okay for me to release this list that I have? And going back to that question about Rule 3.6, Goins properly said, yes, you should release that list to the prosecutor. So even Goins recognized that this was not a confidential communication or something that was protected by the attorney-client privilege. And I won't belabor the point about related to the representation, but this was not at all related to the representation. Repeatedly, there's testimony in the Dubé record that this was a personal errand. If you look at page 116, if you look at page 118, 135, Hawkins testifies that appellant assured me that there was nothing that he was going to take out of the house, that this was not a big deal. He also continues, quote, after we had the conversation about what was going to happen, for me, it resolved my issues. It wasn't something I really felt like was in the scope of my representations, and that's on page 118. And while the military judge did find that Captain Hawkins did have a certain amount of bias and was defensive in his affidavit, the military judge did not undermine Hawkins' testimony with respect to whether he even had a conversation with appellant. It was just whether appellant made a knowing and voluntary waiver as to the information to be disclosed. Also, if I could point this court's attention to Appellate Exhibit 66. On the first page, this is an email that Hawkins sent to Paul Kennedy on 14 March of 2012 at 6:11 p.m. And he says in the email, quote, I'm writing to you on behalf of Lieutenant Colonel Richards to ask for your phone number. Lieutenant Colonel Richards does not have access to your number at the moment, but would like to talk to you about some personal affairs. Again, a personal issue, not anything related to the representation. So moving on to the question of that this court had in actually ordering the Dubé hearing, essentially, that is this something that Hawkins should have known was adverse to appellant when he talked to the trial counsel? And I think this goes to your question earlier to appellant's counsel, Judge Mitchell. Hawkins was putting the trial counsel at ease. When he was approached with this question, he was essentially saying, and this is how Captain Tusing says in his testimony on page 88, calm down. This isn't a big deal. Paul Kennedy moved the dog up to the mom's house. It's not a big deal. Is that a reasonable thing for a defense counsel to do, to kind of call off the dogs when the prosecutor, when the major prosecutor, when the captain prosecutor are both talking to him, and he's just like, you know what, calm down, guys. This isn't a big deal. Paul Kennedy moved this stuff. Paul Kennedy's a friend of his. Is that something reasonable for a defense counsel to do? And the answer is obviously yes. And in hindsight, was it a mistake? Yes, but was it reasonably foreseeable at the time that there would be a password document that was mailed to the home, independent of any kind of movement by Paul Kennedy, mailed to the home by appellant, that then trial counsel was savvy enough then to take to DCFL and say, use this document to then crack this hard drive? There's no way that that's reasonably foreseeable with Hawkins at the time he discloses this. And again, I'll foot stomp. Hawkins did not know that any items had been moved out of the home other than these shot records, the dog, and the car. So he was not, he wouldn't have had any reason to be worried when he talked to the trial counsel. And again, he had been reassured by his client multiple times. Moving on to prejudice, and this is an interesting issue in the prejudice realm, because the question is there a reasonable probability that but for the error, the outcome of the proceeding would be any different? Now, appellate cites Ann Kenney and kind of uses that to hang his hat on, but in Ann Kenney, that was a violation of privilege. Ann Kenney was also the Court of Military Appeals, the follow-up decision, the one he cites is continually the Navy and Marine Corps decision. But the CMA opinion doesn't rest their opinion whatsoever on the constitutional question. They rest it on privilege alone. So as we argue in our brief, we don't think Ann Kenney is very helpful to this court. But the interesting part of the prejudice here is, do you apply a sort of fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine when you're looking at what effect does this have on the proceeding? And I'd like to point out that this is not the Fourth Amendment, this is the Sixth Amendment. In the court in, we cited in the Tenth Circuit case in Nickel v. Hannigan, they said, quote, there is not an indication the law requires the exclusion of all evidence derived from a breach of an attorney-client privilege. Further, other courts have refused to apply such a broad evidentiary rule of exclusion to breaches of privilege. They essentially said that you do not apply a fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. And that was actually the case, kind of appellant alluded to the crazy hypothetical about the murder, and then there's a body. In that case, the pretrial attorney actually disclosed that his client had murdered somebody, and the Tenth Circuit declined to apply the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. And actually, if you shepherdize that case and you look at the district court decision, the district court finds and distinguishes Ann Kenney, and the district court finds that the Sixth Amendment had not even attached yet pre-trial. So that's also an interesting issue, which I'll get to in a moment. But this is all, the Supreme Court in Nix v. Williams and in the case of Michigan v. Tucker, for example, they don't apply, you don't always apply the exclusionary rule to every single constitutional amendment. That is a specific rule, the Wong Sun Doctrine, that is applied to most typically the Fourth Amendment. It's certainly not applied to a Miranda situation. If the government fails to warn and somebody discloses the location of the body, the Supreme Court has said you can use the bodies as evidence even though the confession was obtained improperly. So the government would say that in this case, merely because there was this ethical violation, if you find that there was an ethical violation, that doesn't then mean that you would exclude this derivative evidence that has no connection whatsoever to the initial disclosure. Now, appellant is essentially arguing that that disclosure was the entire basis for the probable cause. And if you could turn to the, make sure I get the right appellate exhibit here, but it's essentially the search warrant, the New Jersey search warrant. It's appellate exhibit 69. On pages 16, 17, and 18, it lists essentially the probable cause that they found after 15 March. And one of the big pieces of probable cause in the application for a search warrant is on page 18. And it references the 6 May 2012, it says 2011, it's a typo, but the 6 May 2012 discussion that appellant had with his mother on the phone, where appellant tells his mother, do not consent to any search of my stuff at your house, essentially. Now, this happened on 6 May. The disclosure happened on 18 May. There was some testimony by Captain Tusing that he may or may not have listened to that discussion before or after the disclosure. But the important part, though, whether it was before or after, is that he would have listened to that conversation. He testified that he was in the habit of during the course of investigation pulling not just the logbooks of who visited the appellant, not just the phone calls, but also the letters as well. And lo and behold, Mr. Kennedy satisfied all three of those things. He wrote, appellant wrote Mr. Kennedy a letter. He talked to him on the phone on 18 May, actually the same day of the disclosure. And also appellant talked to his mother. So Captain Tusing would have eventually found, not he would have questioned the mother, and he would have eventually found Mr. Kennedy as a result of his investigation. And if you look at also the appellate exhibit, the speedy trial chronology, where Captain Tusing actually says that he reviewed the 6 May conversation. That occurs, I believe, on 23 May, and this is at the Dubé record at page 93. And this was actually before he received the list from Mr. Kennedy. So he listened to this conversation prior to knowing the extent of what was moved out of the home. So that's another factor this court has to consider. If it's going to apply some kind of Fourth Amendment fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, then you also have to apply an inevitable discovery type analysis as well, the government would argue.
Counsel, let me ask you the question that was asked to opposing counsel, as you mentioned, inevitable discovery. Is the burden on you as the government to prove inevitable discovery, or is the burden on the appellant under the Sixth Amendment to prove prove the prejudice?
If an inevitable discovery applies, which, again, I'm not sure that it does, but if it does, appellant, he still bears the burden because this is an IAC claim. The burden doesn't shift at any point in the prejudice prong. And it's difficult to get your mind around it because typically when there's a constitutional violation, it's just there's the constitutional violation and then you apply the prejudice test. But in this case, the prejudice test is almost built into the Sixth Amendment analysis, so it's kind of difficult to get your head around, or at least for me, as to whether you even apply any kind of fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. And the case law is not clear. But again, if you do, you ought to apply not just dissipation of taint, which I think is a big factor to consider in the warrant, but also inevitable discovery as well. And the military judge did say he couldn't find beyond a preponderance of the evidence inevitable discovery only with regard to whether the hard drive would have eventually been cracked by DCFL, but he reserved to this court the questions of whether Captain Tusing would have eventually discovered Mr. Kennedy. And when you're looking at the actual text of what the prejudice standard is would it have had an impact on the proceeding? The proceeding didn't occur until well later. There was ample time, and Captain Tusing was obviously a very diligent prosecutor. He would have found Mr. Kennedy, and he wouldn't, upon discovering Mr. Kennedy, he wouldn't have just said, I'm not going to interview that person. In fact, on page 71, he says he was questioned by trial counsel. So the record is that appellant Paul Kennedy on 18 May appellant contacted him from the Bay County facility. Would you have talked to Paul Kennedy having seen that phone call in the log? And Captain Tusing answered, that was my pattern of behavior at the time, so I believe I would have. Moving on briefly to the Sixth Amendment issue, and the question is, does the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attach? And it's not clear, and I think this goes to your question, Judge Teller, about there are different rights articulated in the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused has a right to speedy trial, a confrontation clause, et cetera, et cetera. And the government's not going to argue that speedy trial certainly attaches in the event that there is a pretrial confinement hearing. But the fact that confinement and the restriction of liberty is so connected to the need for a speedy trial, that necessitates why that applies at that particular moment. But as far as the Sixth Amendment generally, and the military case law is that in U.S. v. Jordan, which I'll get to in a moment, but the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply until well after indictment or even Article 32 hearing, because there's case law that says it doesn't apply in an Article 32 hearing. That's a trial right. This right, the military courts have found in U.S. v. Jordan, and that was listed in our supplemental site 29 MJ 177, they said, quote, the mere formation of an attorney-client relationship does not trigger a Sixth Amendment right to the presence of counsel, and they cite a Supreme Court case there. They go on to say, pretrial confinement does not initiate adversary judicial proceedings or otherwise trigger the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Now, that case was later vacated. There's a kind of a strange appellate history with that case, but it was on other grounds. It appears because a year later, the CMA cites Jordan definitively in U.S. v. King. That's 30 MJ 59, and they say, quote, in a footnote, at the time of appellant's confession, quote, adversary judicial proceedings had not commenced, therefore the Sixth Amendment right to counsel had not yet attached, unquote.
Counsel, let me ask you, isn't there a difference, though, between the right to counsel, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and a Sixth Amendment right that if you have counsel, that counsel needs to be competent?
I think there is a difference, Your Honor, but I think in order to have the latter, you need to have the former, that I think it's a contingent right that you actually have to be entitled to counsel before you're entitled to effective counsel.
Well, in United States versus Vasquez, our Superior Court was dismissive of language talking about military due process and instead said, made it clear that service members have only the due process rights provided by the plain text of the Constitution, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the Manual for Court-Martial. Doesn't RCM 305 give the accused a right to counsel at pretrial confinement hearings? So independent of the Constitution, the RCM provides a right to counsel at pretrial confinement hearings.
I don't want to mix terms, Your Honor, because right has a very important, I mean, it's a term of art. So right would be a constitutional right. Is it a constitutional right? No. Is it a right granted by the president? Yes. But there is a difference between the two.
Okay. Can the president grant additional rights beyond what is provided through the Constitution? Isn't that a premise of military law?
He can, but I think that does not then transform that right into essentially a constitutional entitlement where you would apply the Strickland test. Would you apply a due process, not military due process, because we know that that doesn't exist, but would you apply a due process framework? Certainly you would. But does a violation, worst-case scenario, and this is, again, the appellant concedes this, worst-case scenario, a violation of an ethical rule, does that pretrial that leads to the discovery of evidence down this long causal chain, does that violate the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment? Absolutely not, no. The due process clause, to reach some kind of notion where this is a violation of due process, would be a situation perhaps like a privilege violation or where an attorney actually goes and says and writes exactly everything down that his client said. But the attachment of the Sixth Amendment, it's important to draw a line, and I think the Court of Appeals for the CMA recognized that it was important to draw a line because you could extend this argument all the way back until, let's say, an individual commits a crime and then immediately hires an attorney before the government knows about it, just prophylactically. Nobody here, I don't think anybody would here argue that if that attorney then went disclose something, that that would be a Sixth Amendment violation. Again, if it was egregious enough, it may be a Fifth Amendment violation. But that where the Sixth Amendment attaches has meaning. And our court has said, our Superior Court has said that it attaches at a particular point at pre-referral. And I don't think the Supreme Court case...
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you again. And that is, I won't use the word right, the presidential entitlement to counsel. You're saying that that entitlement is to counsel, but not necessarily to competent counsel. Is that your argument?
That not necessarily constitutionally effective counsel. And that may sound strange under the Sixth Amendment, but if you look at, I mean, but that's what the Supreme Court has dictated. And I think the Supreme Court case that appellant cites is not, in this situation, it has no meaning because if you look at that particular case, they're referring to Brewer v. Williams and older cases, and they're saying that this isn't a new situation, that this was essentially they were deciding a case they had decided years before. So those cases have been decided before Jordan.
How do you distinguish, then, Lafler versus Cooper, a 2012 Supreme Court case, where the Supreme Court explicitly rejects the Solicitor General's position that errors prior to trial are not cognizable under the Sixth Amendment? So you seem to be saying we should ignore that Supreme Court language and just treat it as dicta, where they said, Solicitor General, you're wrong when you say that pretrial errors are not cognizable under the Sixth Amendment.
Pre-trial rights are not, but pre-indictment rights are. There's a difference. So if I could point this court to Maine v. Moulton, that's 474 U.S. 159. The concern for the Supreme Court is critical stages in the proceeding. They say, quote, we have found that the right attaches at earlier critical stages in the criminal justice process where the results might well settle the accused's fate and reduce the trial itself to mere formality. So the right attaches in the civilian world at indictment. In the military world, the equivalent to that is it attaches at pre-referral. Now, the cases where you're dealing with initial appearances, that is when somebody has already been formally charged. You do not have that in this case. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Counsel, I do want to ask you about Missouri versus Frye then, where the Supreme Court talks about criminal defendants having a right to effective counsel during plea negotiations. Again, you would distinguish that as being post-indictment versus pre-indictment.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that Justice Kennedy, although he drew a pretty vehement dissent from Justice Scalia and three other justices, that Kennedy was essentially saying that, listen, the plea negotiations are just as important. They've become just as important in American jurisprudence. So they're essentially a critical stage because 98% of cases get resolved in plea negotiations. So we can't just say that somebody isn't without a remedy in that particular case.
You may conclude.
Thank you. It's important to point out that the government never acted maliciously with bad faith or with the intent to subvert appellant's rights in this case. At all times, the government acted reasonably. Equally reasonable in this case was Mr. Hawkins. When asked about the movement of items from appellant's home, he did his best to put the prosecutors at ease that the movement was merely a personal errand conducted by Mr. Kennedy to return the dog, Shadow, to his mother's house. The other developments in the case, Mr. Kennedy voluntarily giving trial counsel the list of items moved, Captain Miller informing trial counsel that he had been solicited to move items, and the 6 May 2012 jailhouse phone call where appellant directed his mother not to consent to searches were the reason why the government ultimately searched appellant's mother's home. Also important, the Sixth Amendment does not apply to the situation faced here. To extend its protections to pretrial confinement hearings would be improper and would run roughshod over our Superior Court's precedents. As Justice Scalia warned in Missouri v. Frye, quote, the Constitution is not an all-purpose tool for judicial construction of a perfect world. And when we ignore its text in order to make it that, we often find ourselves swinging a sledgehammer where a tack hammer is needed. Appellant received a fair trial. At all critical stages of the proceeding, he received constitutionally effective assistance of counsel. He is therefore entitled to zero relief. Thank you.
Our crowd is thinning, Judge. Your Honors, I have a lot to cover. I'd like to, so I'll speak quickly. Your Honors, I said early in the very beginning of my argument that there were earlier stages when the attorney-client privilege attached in this case. There were three. One is, of course, according to U.S. v. Rothgary, at the pretrial confinement hearing. Two is, and it's very important for us to remember this, the appellant had engaged the services of Captain Hawkins at least a year prior in order to effectuate what can arguably be resolved as defense matters or legal assistance matters, but as it related to the modification of a no-contact order. I said that there were three, there were two. And so it is clear that the attorney-client relationship had attached at the time that this breach took place. And, Your Honor, to answer Judge Teller's question as to what other Sixth Amendment rights apply at that time, we would to some degree agree with the government. Certainly the right to speedy trial attaches at that time. I've never really researched the issue of whether or not you have the right to a public pretrial confinement hearing. I don't suppose that you do, but certainly the speedy trial and the right to the effective assistance of counsel attach at the time of the pretrial confinement hearing, according to U.S. v. Rothgary. Your Honors, the government tells you that the conduct of Captain Hawkins did not fall measurably below that of an effective counsel. With all due respect, if a breach of the attorney-client privilege does not fall below the standard of a reasonably competent counsel, nothing does.
But you conceded that it wasn't privileged. So the question is whether confidentiality causes that.
You said that I conceded that there wasn't a breach?
You conceded that it wasn't privilege.
There wasn't privilege, but what I meant to say is that a breach of the confidentiality requirement does not violate that standard. Nothing does.
Would it have been, for your argument, would it have been a breach of confidentiality if Captain Hawkins had asked trial counsel ahead of time and said, hey, a friend of my client's going to come down and get the dog and get the shot records and drive the car and the dog and the shot records to his mom's house?
Without an agreement from the appellant, I would argue that it is. Now, Captain Hawkins wants us to believe that there was an agreement with the appellant, and I think the debate judge did a fine job of ascertaining that there was not.
What standard does counsel use to decide which things he has to get that explicit agreement on and which things are impliedly authorized by the representation?
I think anything that is involved and encompassed within the confidential communications between an attorney and a client. So, for example, Judge, client comes to me and says, okay, I did the drugs. I'm willing to cut a deal. It is perfectly permissible for me to contact the government and say, where do we stand on the possibilities of a plea agreement? It is not permissible for me to call the government and say, we did drugs, or he did the drugs, can we cut a deal?
Is it permissible for you to ask the government, are you finished with the crime scene, can I get access to it?
No, I would certainly never do that.
So you can't, if the crime scene is closed, you can't ask the government for access to it?
That is why make sure I understand that, Judge. Maybe I answered that too quickly. Are you meaning in terms of doing your own investigation or for some other purpose? I think that's the distinction. If you're saying, I want to do my own investigation, I want to go to the crime scene, then certainly you can. But to just leave it amorphously, you know, my client wants me to go do something, no. Your Honors, the court needs to remember that Captain Hawkins himself, at the debate hearing, said any layperson would know that this could trigger a search. That's extremely, extremely important. A couple of other things I'd like to cover, Your Honors, before I close. With regards to United States versus Ann Kenny, government counsel was simply incorrect. The language that we quoted in Ann Kenny is from the CMA decision, which specifically states that evidence derived as a result of a breach of attorney-client confidentiality cannot be used to convict the appellant. That is it. As a result, Your Honors, the evidence in this case should not have been used against the appellant, and therefore the specification it was, you're going to have to forgive me, but the specification and the charge that resulted in the conviction from the conduct of the government counsel and Captain Hawkins denied the appellant the right to the effective assistance of counsel, and therefore the appellant's conviction should be overturned. Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank counsel for both sides for their arguments as well as their briefs. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All right.